The Disciplined Investor is underwritten by Interactive Brokers. Interactive Brokers charges USD margin loan rates from 0.75% to 1.59%. Rates subject to change. Learn more at ibkr.com/compare. And this episode is sponsored by Masterworks, where you're invited to join an exclusive community investing in blue chip art. Check out masterworks.io and use promo code TDI to skip the massive waitlist.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Memes, themes, and dreams. What's the market all about these days? Hot inflation causes no angst and waiting on the next Fed meeting. Our guest today is Elaine Stokes, EVP and Portfolio Manager at Loomis Sayles. All this and much more on episode number 718 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Summer is here, the weather is warm, and the markets are heating up. Well, at least compared to where we were in May, things are looking a little bit better than they were. Welcome to the TDI, or the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I'm Andrew Horowitz, your host, hoping all is well with you, and you're on your way to becoming a disciplined investor. That's what we do here. That's what it's all about. It's about you. It's about making sure that you are on the road to your financial security, whatever that means to you, whether it's college savings, buying a house, whether it's retirement, whether it's making sure that you never have to worry about money or run out of money. Maybe it's thinking about, you know, I'm going to be getting a little bit older. Here I am at 60 years old or 65 years old. How do I protect what I have and make sure that, I don't know, maybe if I do live a really long life that my money doesn't run out before I do. You know, not outliving your money. That's what we talk about, ways in which that you can have that financial security, no matter what that means to you. And we do that by talking about a variety of topics, bringing on some great guests, and slowly but surely educating you in a way that you can understand and then implement. Work with the ideas and work with the concepts. Think about all the different things that piece together in order to make sure that you are where you need to be. So I thought what we do is do a quick recap of the last few weeks and what we've been discussing, because we've been really talking and I've been really pushing the button of diversification over the last several episodes, because I think it's a really important point of time. Where we are right now with the markets, there is some indications that, well, we're reaching peak levels of possibility of commodity prices and of growth and of maybe valuations. And with that in mind, whether we are there right now or not, or whether it's going to take some time or not, I think it's really important to consider the idea of making sure that you are set up properly. Your portfolio is aligned with what it should be. Now, listen, I'm not saying there's going to be an immediate break in the market, so there's going to be some catastrophic or cataclysmic issue that happens that's going to just be devastating. Something that's looming, something that's, you know, I can point to and say, yeah, look at that, yeah, that's bad. I mean, we do have an excess in the markets. There is a massive amount of liquidity. There is uber bullishness. There is massive speculation. There is a lot of money in the system and liquidity. So while there may not be this immediate break and we do see a lot of frothiness and we do see a lot of animal spirits really charging up and getting to a point that you have to kind of step back and say, hey, you know, maybe I need to be a little more cautious in certain areas, but a little more aggressive in others. We know that there is a lot of money due to ultra-easy monetary policy. So we have to say on the side of, well, I would say generally a bullish bias, but always diversified. Really diversified. I'm not talking about, oh, I got five different names and that does it. No, I'm talking about really diversified where you have your small, mid, large cap, your value growth, your international, your emerging markets, your diversified and developed foreign markets, maybe some dollar hedged and some in local currency. Looking at bonds in the area of duration and maturities and domestic and international, some alternatives, real estate, the list goes on. Some inflation protection in your portfolio. And a couple of weeks ago, we talked with Kevin Hoffman, who we discussed the idea of what really is the area of diversification, asset allocation. How do you get to that point, and how do you make sure your portfolio is set properly with the consideration of diversification, not just for the sake of diversification? In other words, giving yourselves the largest amount of opportunity for long-term growth, but yet at the same time, doing your best to limit downside risk. Downside, as we call it, deviation. Not just overlap, but yet optimization. Then last week we talked about alternative investments. I'm telling you this because I want to make sure that you listen to these episodes, that you spend a little time doing it. I talk about a lot of this in my first book, The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success. You can get that on Amazon on audio. I do the read on that, if you could stand that, with a very nasal voice back in the early days, about 12 years ago. But you can listen to that on Audible, The Disciplined Investor, and it gives you a nice breakdown of a variety of areas considering asset allocation, but also gets into like options, gets into charting. Very basic and very, I would say, kind of 101-ish. Some of the things may be a little over your head, some of them not, but gives you a real good background. It is important to educate yourselves on all of this. But we talked about alternative investments last week. We talked about the idea of why do we want to include some of those inside of a diversified portfolio. So this week, I wanted to bring in another leg into that discussion of diversification in the big picture. Now, wait, hold on. We're going to talk about fixed income, but do not turn off this podcast. Do not push the stop button. Hang on. I know when you start thinking about the idea of fixed income, you're like, oh no. Oh boy, that's boring. Who wants to talk about bonds? No, not me. I get it. I totally get it. Because the subject could be boring. You know, it's not like you hear on the news at night, oh, this bond really did some unbelievable things, jumped up, and the traders are really getting on this. No, that's not what you hear. You hear about all these other meme names. You hear about the stocks that are coming out with earnings. You don't really talk about the bond side of things. I get it. But we need to have this discussion. And I have a great guest on the subject. So if nothing else, what I want you to do is think about this in terms of just a quick educational, once a year-ish conversation about a topic that's important to have as part of any portfolio, or at least have as a potential inclusion in your portfolio during certain times. Because there actually are some areas within the fixed income universe that are pretty exciting. No, not as exciting as cryptocurrency. No, not that. But there are some areas that can actually do well for you over time. So it's something to talk about. So we have all this going on. I want to, before we get to our guest, which we're going to kind of do in just 2 minutes, minute and a half, we've been talking about alternative investments, right? And let's just take a moment and bring in our great sponsors, Masterworks, because you may be concerned with the performance of your portfolio over the next several years. And if so, here's something to consider. JP Morgan, BlackRock, and many other analysts are projecting public equity returns of 3-5% over the next 5 years. That's their number. Even the analysts at Bank of America are urging investors to consider real assets as part of an inflation strategy for government spending. So you have to ask yourself, where are some of the smartest people putting their money? And there's plenty of research pieces that show endowments like Yale and Harvard and many top asset managers are looking towards alternative investments. Interestingly, for endowments over $1 billion, the average endowment is investing 55% in alternatives. And these are the managers that have produced the impressive returns for decades. So you should know about investing alternatives in asset class we talked about. Yep, I mean, there's a lot of them. So which one? Well, studies have shown that contemporary art has appreciated 14% annually from 1995 to 2020, outperforming other real asset classes like real estate and gold. You know, it's another piece to have in the portfolio. Masterworks.io is disrupting the centuries-old asset class of art by selling shares in multi-million dollar paintings by artists like Banksy and Picasso and Warhol. You know those names. So for the first time ever, you can allocate a portion of your portfolio to one of the best performing asset classes over the past 25 years, and Masterworks.io is the place to check out. If you want to get started, go to Masterworks.io, use the code TDI to skip the 30,000 person waiting list. See important information and disclaimers at masterworks.io/disclaimer. Now, I also want to talk about one other thing because we talk about this before. We're talking about different ways to earn income, right, on your portfolio, some alternative ideas that you may not have thought about before. So we got to bring up the whole idea of thinking about the stock yield enhancement program with Interactive Brokers, something that a lot of people don't think about because this is a way for you to look and get extra income by pretty much doing nothing with your portfolio, but turning on an option. Because Interactive Brokers Stock Yield Enhancement Program lets you earn extra income on fully paid shares of stock within your brokerage account. So here's how it works. You and Interactive Brokers lend their shares that you hold to traders who pay an interest rate to borrow them, and you receive 50% of the income earned. It's that simple. You got to check this out. I want you to look at opening an Interactive Brokers account today and start earning extra income. Learn more about this. This go here. Check this out. IBKR.com/SYEP. We got links over on the show notes for episode 718 as well. Well, with that in mind, we need to get to our guest and talk about fixed income, what I told you is going to be pretty exciting because this is a heavyweight in the world of fixed income. So over the last few weeks, you know, we've been talking about alternative investments. We've been talking about buffers. We've been talking about diversification, asset allocation, sector allocation. And I wanted to get to a topic today that is something that we don't talk about that often because the exciting stuff is all about stocks. It's all about, you know, looking at the things that are on the edge of blowing up to a great level where you can make a lot of money. But what about the other side of the portfolio? So for that, our guest today is Elaine Stokes. She's an executive vice president of Loomis Sayles, and she's portfolio manager, co-head of full discretion at Loomis Sayles & Company. She's had 33 years of investment industry experience and joined Loomis in 1988, which is when I started pretty much in the business. And she's also a member of the board of directors of the firm. She's also co-portfolio manager for the firm's flagship Loomis Sayles Bond Fund, as well as, and I could list it on and on because it goes on and on of what she's involved with over at Loomis. Bottom line, she's got some cred. Elaine, thanks for coming aboard today. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
You know, you kind of have, there's not much more room on your resume for anything like, because it's everything is so, just so much. It's fantastic. I love that. You have a lot of depth.
I'm a little bit offended that you're talking about bonds the way you are. Come on, this is the exciting side of that.
Well, they always say that the fixed income market is the smart side of the market, the smart side of the family, right? And it's the stock guys are just the dumb lugs that come along for the ride, I guess, right?
I don't know. Watching these MEM stocks, I'm starting to believe that.
So I want to talk about a few things because there's a lot going on in the bond and fixed income side. Obviously, a lot of things where it's really interesting. But there's something that's really in a lot of your writings, a lot of things you talked about is the credit cycle, right? And a lot of things that you really adhere to and you talk about regularly is the credit cycle. And that's an approach that you have for investing. Can you kind of like take us through some of that?
Yeah, absolutely. So what do I mean by the credit cycle? It's simple. Where are we in the credit cycle? Are we in recovery? You know, where we have, growth and prosperity and company spending? Are we in expansion where, you're still spending, but you're starting to look like this cycle's gone on for a long period of time? Are we in the downturn? You know, are we sitting in March? Or are we just starting to work our way out of that into credit repair? And everybody's trying to figure out where we are in that credit cycle, because at different points in that credit cycle, you want to be positioned differently. Mm-hmm. You know, when you want to buy, you want to buy right when you figure out that we're coming out of the downturn and we're going into credit repair. You don't want to be doing all your buying when we're late cycle. You know, so it's really important for us as investors, not only to figure out where we are big picture in the credit cycle, but you also have industries that can be in different parts of their own credit cycle.
Right.
So
first of all, you're a Red Sox fan?
Absolutely.
I heard it in your voice. I heard the twang. I had a feeling I could see you. You're going to be at the bar throwing stuff at the TV when they're down two and they got to make a big comeback. You're wearing the hat. You're wearing the shirt. You got it all going on, right?
I don't know. That might have been me last night watching that Bruins game. Sports fan through and through. The dog was prowling at me. It was interesting.
So let's talk a little bit about where we are then. So, and then I have a secondary question. I said, I wonder, is the credit cycle busted? So where are we, first of all, in the peak to trough, recovery, in the downturn, upturn, growth? Where are we?
Look, we're in the recovery. You know, I'm starting to think we're moving into expansion.
Right.
Right. We're definitely at least in the recovery going towards expansion. And this is probably one of the most interesting years I've ever lived through. We went full circle.
Yeah. Yeah.
And at different points in the cycle, we take advantage of different strategies in our portfolios. So we started out super defensive at the end of last year because it was pre-COVID and we had been in an expansion for 10 plus years. Mm-hmm. And we were, avoiding losers and really trying to be defensive. And then we went into COVID and we opened up the floodgates and started spending our money and realizing that things were just, that was a liquidity event. But it was a liquidity event that we knew was going to become an economic downturn. And we had it's not easy to buy in those times.
But when
you have both a liquidity event and an economic downturn kind of coinciding, you're going to misprice securities. You're going to treat everything like it's going under. And then we've kind of worked our way back through as the Fed came in, as all these different new policies and spending happened. And here we are again, back to expansion.
Let me back up. So when you talk about where there's a mispricing in the market and when there's something where you have an opportunity, one of the things that I talk about a lot is the lesser known implications of those kinds of events, right? Where you have a situation where there's a fire sale going on where people are like, I just need to sell. And there's no rationale other than that. I need to sell. It could be primarily from either funds or primarily from ETFs that are getting sell orders and they have to get rid of it. Is that one of your favorite times to grab the mispriced securities from ETFs that are just selling out?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. No market is more fun than one that there are four sellers and you have cash.
Yeah.
And you have positioned yourself with cash. Kind of reminds me of April of last year. We had kind of an interesting event. Same idea. We had companies who all of a sudden found themselves going into a lockdown with no working capital that had to come to the marketplace. Well, that's a great time to buy too. We had all these companies, the likes of Morgan Stanley and Disney and, really strong, well-known companies coming to the market at fire sale prices because they had to, because they just needed cash.
Right. So one of the best things that happened on top of all that was just right after that, we had Mr. Moneybags, Mr. Powell, come in and say, well, we're buying everything, right? He came in and bought municipals. He bought corporates. What do you think about the Fed's buying of companies like Disney, like Apple? Like, was that really necessary? Or was that just cover so they could buy other stuff, other stuff too that was much more fragile?
Yeah, so the way I looked at it, the Fed came in for a couple reasons. First of all, they came in because markets were not functioning. The U.S. Treasury market was not functioning. Without the U.S. Treasury market functioning, that's the reference rate for everything else that trades in the corporate market, in the fixed income markets. We were frozen. So they came in to restore functioning markets. And by restoring functioning markets, they had credits like Carnival Cruise, Marriott, Southwest Airlines, American Airlines, pick any airline company. They had credits like that, that they would have had to have bailed out and helped in another way, able to use those functioning markets.
Right.
So it alleviated some of what they were going to have to do on the other side by getting the markets up and functioning again. And it kind of got us, you know, buyers back into the market and helping keep the economy running. And we were able to see, hey, if the Fed's going to be there for us, they're not going to let this whole thing unravel and fall apart. And it gave us enough time to start to hear the fiscal side, the fiscal story. So I think it was important in two respects. You know, it was the Band-Aid of getting the markets up and running, but it also allowed them to focus where they needed to focus.
But how long does this go on for? I mean, is there a problem with the long-term price discovery? If we believe that the Fed is always going to come to the rescue, nobody fails. Even failed companies don't fail. I mean, Hertz went through a bankruptcy and, oh my gosh, their common stock wasn't even taken out. I mean, how do we live in a world where nothing fails?
Yeah. You know, there's, we always worry about this, right? We always worry about this idea of moral hazard. So let me remind you that a lot failed last year. You know, one of the reasons I still like the credit market today is because there were so many defaults last year and downgrades, companies that just couldn't make it. You know, the retailers, the energy companies, companies that that needed to wash out, they were allowed to fail. What the Fed did and what the markets did was differentiated between COVID-related problems and we just don't need as many brick and mortar retailers. We just don't need as many energy companies that need $80 prices to survive. So the market did allow companies to fail. I almost look at all the recovery financing and a lot of what happened. It's almost think of it like as wartime financing. Mm-hmm. It was definitely a different animal. There was nothing normal about last year.
No, I get that. And the thing is, though, that it's also propped up things that maybe shouldn't still be around. I mean, you look at certain companies out there that had some issues. I mean, for example, you know, you look at oil prices. I don't want to get to this whole side of the discussion, but oil prices, $70 when we're going through an electric car EV revolution. Or you look at movie theaters where we have all of these incredible, streaming going on right now. It just seems like there's a little bit of weirdness in terms of, you know, if Hertz doesn't fail, JCPenney doesn't fail, Sears doesn't fail, the mall operators are still doing their thing. It's just still like there was this incredible amount to prop up. And I think we all have to admit that there is some moral hazard. But the question is, are what you're looking at now in the fixed income market in terms of pricing, because a lot of what this is predicated on is the fact that there's massive amount of money that has to be spent by a lot of places, right? And it's so inexpensive to issue the debt. What the hell? Let's issue some debt at 2% and be done with it. Is there a mispriced or mismatch issue at this point that's starting to show through?
Yeah, you know, you're an equity guy, I'm a fixed income person. I would say, you know, I worry about some of the mispricing in the equity land.
Yes, I agree.
You know, I joked about the MEM stocks. You know, there's different, lots of different things that I feel like are being mispriced. I can look at the fixed income market and say, yeah, you know, should triple C's trade at a yield of 620? That just doesn't feel right. You know, we need to be compensated more for that. So that's where it's a market to me where, yes, there are mispricings, but is the overall market mispriced? It's hard for me to say that when I look. It's what are you looking at versus? What are you comparing it to? And look at the rest of the world. I mean, we have negative interest rates in a lot.
Well, that's the big issue, isn't it, right there? Isn't that the crux of the matter, that when we're doing a review and we say we have to do a comparison, like currency, you go against this, against that, right? You say, well, the U.S. is still yielding, you know, 1.5% on the 10-year, but we look over at Europe or we look at Japan, we look at other places and they're negative. So you say, well, maybe we're still high. As crazy as that sounds, right? So there's a little bit of an arbitrage available there. So what are you doing in 2021? 2020, you clearly got some great opportunities. You gobbled up with the cash that you had. You were able to stretch and to steal from the ETFs. I say that in a good way because we've done some research, by the way. And the reason we use funds for our global allocations for our clients in the area of fixed income primarily is due to the fact that all the studies that we've done going back on three-year rolling returns, risk-adjusted returns, a whole bunch of statistical analysis for years and years and decades was that mutual funds net of all fees outperform with better risk-adjusted returns in mass in the fixed income side under, and we split it up by sector, right? You know, whether it's corporate or it's treasury or it's emerging market or it's developed market debt. They outperformed. And the only thing that we came up with was that there are those times that there's mispricing and mutual funds get to pick it up and win where ETFs, or for that matter, where ETFs need to buy, they're just buying whatever price there is. So that also gives you a benefit of selling to them at any price.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it pays, in the fixed income markets, it still pays to be an active manager.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, more money went passive in the last few years leading up to COVID. And I think that made it an even more interesting, fruitful time for those of us who are active.
Right. So what are you going to do in 2021? Let's say that we are now approaching the expansion time. That's where we are, possibly, out of recovery into expansion. What are we looking to do in terms of maturities, duration, risk, credit rating, et cetera?
Yeah. So I'll start with from a duration perspective. There's a couple things to look at from a duration perspective. The first thing to look at is the indices have gotten incredibly long. They've added 2-3 years to where they were pre-COVID. And that's because there's been a ton of issuance and refinancings out. So the indices just feel really long. Oh, and by the way, all kind of else points to interest rates rising for the foreseeable future. Look, the Fed is saying, hey, let them rise. So all good. So we're short and very comfortable being short duration.
Short duration, which means let's kind of just, for those people who don't understand that because they don't really get involved in the credit or the fixed income markets, that means that you are favoring short term and you are saying that you believe longer term debt is going to feel more pain and therefore you're comfortable betting against it.
Exactly. What we're saying is, we're going to take risk in our portfolios. We would prefer it not to be interest rate risk. We want to focus the risk in our portfolios on credit risk, which is what we think we do best.
Mm-hmm. So that's 2021. Now let's just tail up on one comment that you made there, because we saw that the 10-year a couple of months back or through the last month or so hit about 1.75. And everybody's like, oh, it's going to 2 and 3. We got inflation. We have inflation. The question is it transitory? Well, the Fed is trying to hypnotize us to believe that this is just a transitory. With all of the information that you have, that you're seeing in terms of a normal, nothing's normal, a review of this inflation situation that we have going on right now, do you believe it is transitory? It's going to pop back well under 2% again? Or is this something we're going to be dealing with for a while?
It's both.
Oh.
And that's the part that is making this. No, that's the part that's making this so challenging.
Right.
We're going into a period. We're in a major transition where all these big secular trends are pointing to higher inflation. The Fed's average inflation targeting. The politicians finally embracing fiscal policy and just wanting to spend, spend, spend. Globalization somewhat going out of favor. Nobody, you know, people got nervous by what happened last year, and they're re-looking at their supply chains, and they're favoring security over price in some time. They're worried about this just-in-time idea. Even the demographics, you know, there's less cheap labor. So that is all pointing to a long-term secular switch to a little bit more inflation.
Right.
In the meantime, we have this crazy, like, time period we're living through with shortages and, you know, like 5 to 10 year moves in the marketplace taking place overnight. And, you know, the COVID shutdowns and what supply chains are reopening and not. And in this really, really crazy time that is causing a lot of inflation.
Mm-hmm.
That part's transitory. The long-term part is probably going to be here with us for a very, very long time. So what you need to do is both, right? You need to look through the crazy short-term lumber and used cars and that price and toilet paper or whatever it might be, golf clubs, in that part of the inflation. And you need to think, okay, what is the trajectory of when we get back to normal, we'll call it, you know, maybe a year from now, what is the trajectory going to be of that secular change in inflation? And I'd just say secular changes in inflation are slow and long-term and steady. They mean higher rates, but it's going to take a long time.
You know, it's interesting because we have a situation with, if you really think about it for a second, if we say, you know, inflation's going to be 2.5%. That's what's going to average, give or take a little bit over the next number of years. And think about all the money that's been thrown into the system. You know, and think about all of the massive amount of quantitative easing and the low interest rates. If that doesn't get inflation going, what the heck is the point of even thinking about doing anything to get it going? I mean, we look at Japan. That case example is clear enough for me to believe that the Fed has no ability in the current environment to increase rates, inflation. And that point is that, you know, it seems that we could keep spending to a level almost infinitum.
Yeah. So I think, Andrew, I think you hit the nail on the head here. That's why the Fed is much more worried about not having inflation than having inflation.
Right.
That's why they're so willing to say average inflation targeting, higher rates are okay, we're going to be patient. That's why they're doing that.
Well, my opinion is, by the way, about the average inflation. Now, I was at a meeting, had lunch with Ben Bernanke, about a year ago or so, and he brought this subject up about, hey, watch, they're going to start talking about this inflation averaging thing. And I think that all that is, they knew inflation was coming. Now, this is before COVID and all that. They felt it, and they wanted to have cover so they can continue doing what they're doing without worrying. You know, it's like, just let's change the rules if we need to. That's what they did.
Hasn't that been the last, since 2008?
50 years. I mean,
we've gotten quite used to the rules changing.
Right.
But the difference today and the difference, they think, than what Japan was dealing with is kind of a lot of those factors I laid out, right?
Right.
The politics, you know, the willingness to go fiscal policy and spend, the globalization kind of coming back, the demographics changing. You know, we've been dealing with the tech data efficiencies, productivity for a long time. Mm-hmm. That's starting to fade as, you know, efficiency isn't paramount anymore. There seem to be other factors that are being thought about. And, you know, the greening of the economy might be one of them. And I think we're going to see more and more of that. You know, the kind of back off of globalization. That's very political.
If I have one wish, I hope we can go back to being humans for a while instead of all about this being the most efficient, most financially exacting in terms of 0.01 versus 0.02 margin benefit. You know what I'm talking about? You know, go back to being people talking to each other. But that's a whole different can of worms. What areas are you worried about? Are you worried about the pandemic in terms of mutations and changes and I don't know, whatever, or some other kind of disease? Are you worried about, you know, consumers? Well, I mean, what is it that you're concerned about and what you're watching?
I'm absolutely worried about COVID, worried about the pandemic. I'm less worried about the larger developed world countries that have embraced vaccination and are really moving forward. I'm worried about the countries that aren't doing that. I had two conversations yesterday with people, you know, one in an Asian country, one in a European country, both very, very developed. And they both said that they're maybe 10 to 20% vaccinated and nobody believes in the vaccine. Mm-hmm. And that worries me because I do think in neither of them are as open as we are here in the United States. And I think we need everything to get reopened. But I am worried about these strains that we're seeing across a lot of the developing world and how crippling that can be. You know,
meanwhile, mm-hmm. it doesn't, it's not even like if we said right now that the entirety of Europe was going to lock down for 2 weeks, I don't think that would affect markets. I'm not kidding. I don't think anybody in the markets care anymore. They're just concerned about liquidity. As long as there's liquidity, you shut it down. Shut it all down. As long as you keep pumping money into the system fiscally and monetarily, does anybody, seriously, I'm not kidding. Does anybody care?
I think they do. I think that if we went to, like you said, if we shut down all of Europe right now, I think that absolutely affects markets. And I think that, you know, there is a true economic impact of that. Commodities definitely would get hit in that scenario. It's the one of the reasons why I think we can't get past U.S. interest rates being where they are is there's still a fair trade going on.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, people would normally rotate out of the U.S. market and start to buy emerging markets,
right?
Start to be global.
Right.
And they're like, I can't do that yet. You know, can't do that yet.
No, I get it. And which may be the right time to do it, by the way. You know, speaking of which, what sectors, let's kind of go through the sectors of the U.S. markets that you're, or just general sectors, whether it's going to be, you know, retail, maybe energy, maybe tech. What areas do you prefer to look at or not?
Yeah. All right. So when I think about the industries, I'm trying to get involved in industries that have been completely beaten down and have upside.
Mm-hmm.
So airlines.
Yeah, they've been beaten down.
You know, I mentioned Marriott and Southwest earlier. Those are the types of things that they've been through some hard times. And there's so many different ways to play airlines. You can play it through Securitize. You can play it through the aircraft leasers. You can play it through the parks. You can play it through the actual airlines, right? Mm-hmm. So, and I could go the same way around lodging. There's lots of ways to play that. That's a good place to be searching. Another thing you do at this point in the cycle, when you get to expansion, is you start to cull through your portfolio and say, okay, interest rates usually rise at this time. So we need to outrun rising interest rates. What we want to have is upgrade candidates. We had all the downgrade candidates and we were buying the downgrades last year. And that wasn't a problem because they were priced so cheap. Mm-hmm. But now that thing is priced tight to treasuries, what we want to do is find the Netflix, the HCAs, the companies that actually have the wind at their back. And we could see an upgrade because then the spread will tighten. So you'll have your coupon plus some spread compression. And that's those are bonds that can go up.
So let me just roll this back for a second for those people that don't understand and are not really up on the lingo and terminology of a bond professional. Basically, what you're talking about is the equivalent of a stock upgrade, differently looking from a stock that's maybe, let's say, a BB. You know, there's different ratings. There's A, B, C, D, and then there's bad. It just goes to problems. But let's just say it's a C. Let's just say it's a C. Well, that's a kind of a junk bond, we call it. But if it gets an upgrade somehow, because maybe the company's financials are a lot better, their income is solid, everything is good, they can pay their debts, their debt payment ability is much higher, they get an upgrade. What happens when you get upgrades in those kind of situations from the bond services, the rating services, is that means that you have a higher quality bond, high quality financial statement. And the bonds will automatically start moving towards a higher price, lower yield. That's good if you own the stock or the bond, that is. So what they're looking for now is to find some areas that are mispriced in relation to their rating, looking for those that have an improving financial position, therefore will look to get an upgrade on their rating, thereby a pricing bump overall. Does that kind of describe it?
That describes it perfectly. So right now, a double B bond, which is considered a junk bond, trades with a yield of 3.18, mm-hmm. where the average triple B bond, which is the upgrade, right? The next rating category up, is trading at a 2.29.
Wow.
So, you know, that's 90 basis points.
That's huge.
You know, so that really means that, you know, the 10-year can go from 150 to almost 2.5, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you'd be okay if you get that upgrade.
Yeah, that's a big spread. In bond language, that's a big spread. Okay, so kind of let's kind of run through and kind of close this up a little bit, the where we are and refresh and review. So where we are is on the edge of, in the U.S., and maybe to a degree of the world, to a lesser extent, we're in a recovery/expansionary moment, right?
Yes.
And in those kind of situations, we want to watch our maturities, duration of the bonds, funds, et cetera. And, you know, it a lot of people don't know how to do that. That's what we kind of help people do. But you have to look at what you have inside of your funds and your ETFs to understand this. Now, you can see very easily if you have just a single bond in your portfolio and it's a 20-year bond, well, that's what you have. And if you want to hold that, that's fine because you'll get your principal back at maturity. But nonetheless, if you have a fund, an ETF, or some other kind of managed pool of bonds, you want to look at where that maturity is and duration and a few other things, skew issues. You want to look at average rating. And those are the kind of things that you need to do in this kind of market environment. That's why I want to talk about this with Elaine, because you know, bonds could seem to be like, oh, let's not doing anything about them. But sometimes shifting them around ever so gently, right, Elaine, is very beneficial to a portfolio.
Absolutely. Being active and always kind of refreshing what you own. And the last thing I'd want to point out, Andrew, is that the expansion phase of the cycle tends to be the most long-lived. You know, we have a ton of imbalances to work out as we go through this expansion where we all are seeing them every day, right? We're not even fully open. We have a lot to work out.
Mm-hmm.
So we could be in this phase of the cycle for quite some time. So it's really important to position appropriately and constantly be refreshing the portfolio.
The only thing that could happen that could break that, in my opinion, is a liquidity crunch. Would you agree with that?
I would agree. And that is probably a buying opportunity because we'll still be in the expansion from an economic perspective. That's just a breakdown of markets.
And how would that happen? Is that when a taper occurs?
That's maybe when what I'll refer to as a taper tantrum, when the Fed starts to walk back or starts to talk about next phase. Markets get nervous. No expansion is a straight line.
Yeah.
Expansions can be pretty bumpy roads. But that's all good. You know, we like that as investors.
Yeah. And the FOMC meeting, the rate decision, which is kind of more of a press conference more than anything. And, you know, we have the opportunity to hear from the Fed, which will repeat the same thing over and over, that we feel we're in a good position, blah, blah, blah. You know, the same line over and over and over. I wonder how they get tired of this stuff. But then they give the secret handshakes and the, you know, the winks and the nods during the press conference to tell us kind of what there is. And if they're not thinking about, if they're only thinking about talking about it this time without the three thinking about, it could be detrimental to the markets. You know, it's so funny how we watch the Fed so closely, the briefcase indicator for Bernanke and Greenspan and just crazy stuff. I want to thank you, Elaine Stokes from Loomis. We're going to put all the information on how to get in touch with Loomis and all the different funds they have, all the things. We like them. We use them. By the way, we do use them in our portfolios. So we've had a lot of success and think that they're an excellent component of our fixed income after a lot of work that we've done. So check that out over on The Discipline Investor. Go to episode number 718 on thedisciplineinvestor.com, the show notes, and check that all out. Elaine Stokes, thank you so much for coming aboard.
Thank you, Andrew.
Now, that wasn't so bad, was it? Talking about fixed income. Interesting. Good insights. I learned a few things right there. I think it's important to understand where we are in that credit cycle and where we are in the overall economic cycle, designing where you're going to be in your portfolio. You know, that's something important too, is to understand, and we touched upon this, where you want to be within your fixed income if you own fixed income right now. I'm not talking about the individual bonds. I'm talking about if you have funds or ETFs or any other kind of pooled assets, of where it is from a duration and maturity standpoint. If you need help with that, seek out a good financial advisor to make sure that you are not on the wrong side of that barbell, as we call it, that you are looking at your portfolio from a standpoint of where we are in the economic credit cycle, et cetera. Well, we're going to wrap it up right there. Thank you so much for joining me. We'll be again here next week with some really good topics, great topics. Follow me on Twitter, Andrew Horowitz, one word. Give me a like on Facebook. The Disciplined Investor has a page over there as well. Otherwise, I'm wishing you the best and a very profitable week. I'll see you soon. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.